with the odors of lubricating oil and ozone from the electrical machinery. Color-coded pipes and electrical conduits ran overhead. Maintenance robots trundled back and forth along the walkways between the pulsating machinery and the warehouse stacks. Simple-minded machines programmed to alert human controllers of malfunctioning equipment or water leaks. The robots were fairly easy to avoid. Fuchs could see the red lights set into their tops, flashing through the dimly lit passageways, while they were still far enough distant to get out of range of their optical sensors. There was a scattering of other people hiding there, too, a ragged handful of men and women who preferred to scratch out an underground living rather than to submit to Cellini's laws. Some of them were wild-eyed from drugs or raving alcoholics. Others were simply unable or unwilling to live by other people's rules. Fuchs met a few of them, barely avoided a fight when one of them pulled a knife and ordered him to swear loyalty. Fuchs bent his knee and agreed, then quickly moved as far away from the megalomaniac as he could, and never saw him again. Fuchs settled down in the basement, content to sleep in a bedroll and eat canned foods pilfered from the warehouse stocks. He spent his waking hours peering at his palm comp, studying the schematics of Cellini's air ducts and water pipes, searching for a way to penetrate the lunar city's lowest level, where Humphreys lived in his magnificent mansion. As the weeks passed, Nodan, Sanja, and Amarjagal arrived at Cellini one by one, each of them bearing identification as Astro Corporation employees, lowly technicians. Their one-room corporate apartments were sufficient for them, luxurious compared to Fuchs's hideout in the storeroom shelves in the basement. Fuchs visited his crew members, furtively making his way through Cellini's corridors to spend long hours with them, planning how he might kill Martin Humphreys.
Shining Mountain Base. Daniel Jomo Tsavo hated the 3-second lag in communications between the Earth and Moon. It upset him to ask a question and then wait and wait and wait until the answer came back. Yet there was no way around the lag, and now the safety people have warned us that a solar storm is on its way. Normal communications will be disrupted, and all work on the surface will have to stop until the storm passes. Ah, well, he said to himself. This call to Yamagata is on a tight laser beam link. The storm should not affect it unless it's powerful enough to fry the laser transmitter on the surface. Pancho Lane wants to visit your base, Nobuhiko Yamagata replied at last. Tsavo nodded vigorously. She just called. She's at the astral facility in the Malapert Mountains, no more than 100 kilometers from where I sit. Again the interminable lag. Tsavo used the time to study Yamagata. His round, flat face looked frozen, his eyes hooded, his expression unreadable. Yet he must be thinking furiously, Tsavo thought. Come on, come on, tell me what I should do. This is a striking opportunity, Yamagata said at last. Tsavo agreed heartily. I took it on my own authority to invite her to come over tomorrow. Yamagata again seemed lost in thought. At last he said, Don't delay. Bring her to your base as quickly as you can. I will send an interrogation team immediately on a high-G burn. There is much we can learn from her.
Pancho felt slightly nervous being out on the surface with a solar flare cloud on its way. The scientists had estimated that it would take more than 6 hours for the radiation to even begin building up, but she still felt edgy about it. She was wearing a standard hard-shell spacesuit as she followed the Astro Base Director along the crest of Mount Randolph. Approaching storm or not, the director wanted to show off what his people were doing, and Pancho had no intention of showing any fear in front of her own people. I should be testing the soft suit I brought with me, she said to herself. Yet, she answered silently, you know what they say about test engineers. More guts than brains. I'll wear a soft suit when they've been in use for a year or two. Mama Lane didn't raise any of her daughters to get themselves killed trying out new equipment. She was being conducted on a quick walk through the small forest of gleaming white towers that reached up into the bright sunlight. Their wide, circular tops were dark with solar cells that drank in the sun's radiant energy and converted it silently to electricity. They looked like great big mushrooms, Pancho thought. Then she corrected herself. Nope. They looked more like giant penises. She giggled inwardly. A forest of phalluses. A collection of cocks. Monumental pricks. All standing at attention. As you can see, the base director's voice rasped in her earphones, another advantage of the power towers is that the solar cells are placed high enough above the surface so they're not bothered by dust. It took an effort for Pancho to control her merriment. You don't need to clean them off? She said, trying to sound serious. That's correct. It saves quite a bit of money over the long run. She nodded inside her helmet. What about damage from the micrometeoroids? The cells are hardened, of course. Deterioration rate is about the same for the ground arrays around Selene. Mm-hmm. Pancho seemed to recall a report that said otherwise. Didn't the analysis that a new voice broke into their conversation? Ms. Lane, ma'am, we have an incoming call for you from the Nairobi base at Shackleton. Put it through on Freak 2, she said. It was voice only, but she recognized Savo's caramel-rich baritone. Ms. Lane? Pancho, this is Daniel. I am sending a hopper over to your facility within the next half hour. Please feel free to visit us whenever you're ready to. Grinning, delighted, Pancho answered, I'll get over there as soon as I can, Danny. You know that a solar storm is approaching, he said. Pancho nodded inside her helmet. Yep, I'll get to you before it hits. Fine, that's wonderful. Pancho cut her inspection tour short, apologizing to the base director, who frowned with undisguised disappointment. Sure enough, there was a Nairobi Industries hopper standing on its spindly little legs, waiting for her at the launch pad. It was painted a vivid green with the corporate logo, an oval Maasai shield, and two cross spears, stenciled just below the glass-steel bubble of the cockpit. She dashed to the room that the base director had given her for her quarters, picked up her still unopened travel bag, and headed toward the pad. She called Jake Wanamaker on her handheld to tell him where she was going and why. Then she buzzed her security chief and asked him why, in the name of hell and gone, he hadn't been able to locate Lars Fuchs yet. I want him found, she insisted, and pronto.
At that moment, Lars Fuchs was huddled with his three crew members in a narrow, shadowy niche between one of the big electrical power converters and the open-shelved storehouse that he used as his sleeping quarters. This is where you live, Captain? Hammerjagel asked, in a whisper that was halfway between respect and disbelief. This is my headquarters, Fuchs replied evenly, for the time being. Nodan said, You could move in with me, sir. There's no need for you. I'll stay here. Less chance of being discovered. The three Mongols glanced at one another, but remained silent. Over the weeks since Fuchs had gone underground, he had learned the pattern of the maintenance robots that trundled along the walkways set between the machinery and storehouses in Selene's uppermost level. It was easy enough to avoid them, and he swung up into the higher tiers of the warehouse each night to spread his bedroll for sleep. It was a rugged sort of existence, but not all that uncomfortable, Fuchs told himself. As long as he kept his pilfering of food and other supplies down to the bare necessities, Selene's authorities didn't bother to track him down. From what Big George had told him, it was easier for the authorities to accept a slight amount of wastage than to organize a manhunt through the dimly lit machinery spaces and storehouses. The one thing that bothered Fuchs was the constant humming, throbbing that pervaded this uppermost level of Selene. He knew that Selene's nuclear power generators were buried more than 100 kilometers away, on the far side of Alphonsus's Ringwall Mountains, yet there was a constant electrical crackle in the air, the faint scent of ozone that triggered uneasy, earthly memories of approaching thunderstorms. Fuchs felt that it shouldn't bother him, that he should ignore the annoyance. still. His head